The Skeptic Society and John Wagner Recording Studios are proud to present the audio recording of Michael Shermer's book, Denying History, read by the author and produced by John Wagner. This audiobook is abridged and was edited by Michael Shermer. Dr. Michael Shermer is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, the host of Skeptic's Distinguished Science Lecture Series at Caltech, and adjunct professor of Claremont Graduate University. Dr. Shermer received his BA in psychology from Pepperdine University, MA in experimental psychology from California State University, Fullerton, and his PhD in the history of science from Claremont Graduate University. He is the author of many best-selling books, including The Mind of the Market, Why Darwin Matters, The Science of Good and Evil, The Borderlands of Science, How We Believe, and Why People Believe Weird Things, all available as audiobooks. John Wagner Recording Studios is an award-winning producer of audiobooks, music albums, and documentary film scores. Now, please enjoy this recording of Denying History.
Denying History, Holocaust Denial, Pseudo-History, and How We Know What Happened in the Past. Book copyright 2000, audiobook copyright 2009, by Michael Shermer and Alex Grobman. Read by Michael Shermer. Introduction, Who Speaks for the Past? There we sat, an Orthodox Jew, a professional skeptic, and one of the world's authorities on Auschwitz, face-to-face with Ernst Zundel, an all-around Germanophile known for his court cases concerning free speech in Canada, and his media blitzes claiming that the Holocaust never happened. It was a strange experience, the culmination of years of research that led us through a looking-glass world where black is white, up is down, and the normal rules of reason no longer apply. We not only met with those who deny the Holocaust, who deny that during the Second World War, the Nazis and their collaborators carried out the intentional and bureaucratically administered destruction of about 6 million Jews using gas chambers, crematoriums, and other technologies, and basing their actions primarily on racial ideology. We also traveled to the camps themselves, to Dachau, Treblinka, Sobibor, Mauthausen, Majdanek, Belzec, and Auschwitz, including Auschwitz-Birkenau, to test the claims that no mass murders, especially by gassing, took place by intention at these camps. When dealing with the claims of the Holocaust deniers, we believe it is not enough to be ivory tower academics, attempting to achieve objectivity with distance, when the individuals who make these claims are friendly, eager to talk, and merely a phone call or plane ride away. Historians mostly deal with figures who are no longer alive, but here we are dealing not just with history, but with pseudo-history, the rewriting of the past for present personal or political purposes. If we want to know what the proponents of this pseudo-history are like and how they think, what could be more important than meeting and talking to them? Some have argued that a project such as this is degrading and improper for professional historians, which we are by training. We do not agree. Primary sources are the most important tool of the historian, and what could be more primary in writing a book about Holocaust denial than meeting the deniers themselves, seeing their offices, asking them questions, reading their literature, and in general, trying to get inside their minds. Others have argued that to meet with the deniers or answer their claims is to validate them, but we believe that to let their arguments go unanswered presents a greater danger. Was it not Joseph Goebbels who observed that if you repeat a lie often enough, people will believe it? We discovered that most Holocaust deniers are very knowledgeable about very specific aspects of the Holocaust. A gas chamber door that cannot lock, the temperature at which Zyklon B evaporates, or the lack of a metal grid over the peephole on a gas chamber door, so that anyone who is not versed in these specifics cannot properly question and answer their claims. This problem came to our attention in talking to the top Holocaust scholars in the world. In many cases, we have had to go to great lengths during this multi-year project to get answers to our questions. The answers are there, but not in ready-made form. Our book remedies this shortcoming in Holocaust studies. But it does more than this. The purpose of this book is to reveal the difference between history and pseudo-history by using Holocaust denial as a classic case study in how the past may be revised for present political and ideological purposes. In the process, we thoroughly refute the Holocaust deniers' claims and arguments, present an in-depth analysis of their personalities and motives, and show precisely with solid evidence how we know the Holocaust happened. We use this case study to consider how we know any past event happened. Finally, we examine how various observers have explained the Holocaust over the past half century and what these different explanations tell us, not only about the Holocaust, but about ourselves. Chapter 1, Giving the Devil His Due, The Free Speech Issue. Epigram from A Man for All Seasons by Robert Bolt, Act 1, Scene 6. William Roper. So now you'd give the devil the benefit of law, Sir Thomas More. Yes, what would you do? Cut a road through the law to get after the devil? Roper. I'd cut down every law in England to do that. More. Oh? And when the law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide? Yes, I'd give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake. On December 1st, 1996, the New York Times reported that Benjamin Austin, a sociology professor at Middle Tennessee State University, found literature in books on the Holocaust at his college library that more than implied that the Holocaust did not happen. Not long after he removed the leaflets from the books, Austin discovered that they had been replaced by more Holocaust denial material. When he looked into the matter further, he came across the same literature placed in Holocaust books at Davis Kidd Booksellers, Nashville's largest independent bookstore. The publishers of this literature, he soon learned, were the Institute for Historical Review and National Vanguard Books, a division of the West Virginia-based National Alliance. The Institute for Historical Review in Southern California is the leading Holocaust denial organization in the United States. The National Alliance was founded by William Pierce, a.k.a. Andrew McDonald, author of the famed Turner Diaries, an inflammatory novel about the bombing of a federal building similar to that by Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City. Should the Institute for Historical Review be allowed to publish pamphlets, journals, and books denying the Holocaust? Should it be allowed to place them in public libraries and private bookstores? Should the National Alliance be allowed to publish potentially incendiary books, like the Turner Diaries, if they appear to offer blueprints for violence and destruction? At the heart of these questions is one of the most controversial issues any democracy must deal with as it attempts to strike a healthy balance between freedom of expression and protection of the rights of its citizens. As we were producing this audio book, the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. was shot up by a Holocaust denier who was, in fact, a member of the Institute for Historical Review. So these issues are very important and contemporary. The free speech issue. In the United States of America, the First Amendment protects the right of all citizens to question the existence of anything they like, including the death of Elvis, the Apollo moon landing, and the single bullet theory in the JFK assassination. No matter how much an individual may dislike someone else's opinion, even if it is something as shocking as denying that the Holocaust happened, that opinion is protected by the First Amendment. In most countries of the world, however, this is not the case. In Canada, there are anti-hate and anti-pornography statutes and laws against spreading false news that have been applied to Holocaust deniers. In Austria, it is a crime if a person denies, grossly trivializes, approves or seeks to justify the National Socialist genocide or other National Socialist crimes against humanity. In France, it is illegal to challenge the existence of crimes against humanity, as defined by the military tribunal at Nuremberg. Crimes against humanity, namely, murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhumane acts committed against any civilian population before or during the war, or persecutions on political, racial, or religious grounds in execution of or in connection with any crime within the jurisdiction of the tribunal, whether or not in violation of the domestic law of the country where perpetrated. On July 3, 1981, for example, the French Holocaust denier Robert Faurisson was found guilty in a Paris court of defamation and incitement to racial hatred and violence based on a law passed July 1, 1972. Specifically, the court ruled, in accusing the Jews publicly of being guilty through cupidity of a particular odious lie and of a gigantic swindle, Robert Faurisson could not be unaware that his words would arouse in his very large audience feelings of contempt, of hatred, and of violence toward the Jews in France. As recently as April 21, 1998, the journal Nature ran a news item on a brewing controversy in France's National Scientific Research Agency, the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique, involving the revisionist activities of Serge Thion, a CNRS researcher, as well as those of several other scientists. One of those CNRS scientists was Gabor Ritterspohn, who was accused in the German newspaper Berliner Zeitung of denying that the Nazi gas chambers had been used for mass homicide. In response, Ritterspohn successfully sued the paper and cleared his name. But in the trial, it came out that in the 1970s and 1980s, he belonged to extreme left-wing groups that favored free expression for revisionists. The article pinpointed the free speech problem for the CNRS, which is split between the need to preserve academic freedom and a desire to discipline such individuals. In Germany, the Auschwitz Lie Law makes it a crime to defame the memory of the dead. This statute was the result of a judgment by the Federal German Supreme Court on September 18, 1979, when a student whose Jewish grandfather was killed in Auschwitz sued for an injunction against an individual who had posted signs on the fence of his house proclaiming that the Holocaust was a Zionist swindle. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the plaintiff. In calling the racist murders by the Nazis an invention, the statements complained of deny the Jews the inhuman fate which they have suffered on account of their origin. This means an attack on the personality of the people who have been singled out by the anti-Jewish persecutions in the Third Reich. Whoever tried to deny the truth of past events denies to every Jew the respect to which he is entitled. Switzerland, Belgium, Israel, Italy, New Zealand, Sweden, and Australia have similar laws on the books. These laws are all ambiguous enough to allow courts to interpret various Holocaust deniers' activities as illegal. In December 1982, for example, Sweden arrested Dietlieb Culver Felderer, an associate of a leading Holocaust denier, Willis Cardo, when Felderer accused Mel Mermelstein, a Holocaust survivor, of peddling the extermination hoax. Specifically, Felderer was tried because, as the Swedish prosecutor explained, his obscene propaganda against Jews abroad and in Sweden is so large that he must have huge financial backing. This was the first time such a prosecution had been undertaken in Sweden. In Great Britain, the Race Relations Act forbids racially charged speech not only when it is likely to lead to violence, but generally on the grounds that members of minority races should be protected from racial insults. In like manner, in Australia, the New South Wales Parliament amended the 1989 Anti-Discrimination Act to include a ban on racial vilification. The sweeping scope of the government's power to determine what constitutes vilification is remarkable. The law invests in the Anti-Discrimination Board the power to determine whether a report is fair and whether a discussion is reasonable, in good faith, and in the public interest. The board will pronounce upon the acceptability of artistic expression, research papers, academic controversy, and scientific questions. An unfair, i.e., inaccurate report of a public act may expose the reporter and the publisher to damages of up to $40,000. In conflict with more laws of this nature than probably any other historian today, and arguably the most widely known Holocaust denier, David Irving was told by Polish authorities in July 1998 that he would not be allowed to film a documentary at Auschwitz. "They have written, refusing even to allow me, an historian of worldwide reputation, at the site," he wrote in an internet posting. "It is an unprecedented ban." This kind of censure is nothing new to David Irving, who has been banned from numerous countries around the world. While he cannot be legally prohibited from speaking in America, he can be so loudly shouted down that he is essentially banned. On Friday, February 3, 1995, for example, Irving was invited by the Berkeley Coalition for Free Speech to lecture at the University of California, Berkeley. The university allowed it, but student groups did not. More than 300 protesters surrounded Latimer Hall to keep Irving from speaking, and the 113 ticket holders from entering the building. The police were at first unable to control the crowd, fistfights broke out, and Irving was forced to retreat behind his book table for protection until order was restored. Should free speech live and flourish without restriction? Our position regarding the freedom of speech of anyone on any subject is that while the government should not be in the business of limiting speech, an institution should have the freedom to restrict the speech of anyone at any time who utilizes resources within the jurisdiction of its own institution, such as a school newspaper, a classroom, or a lecture hall. The Holocaust deniers should have the freedom to publish their own journals and books, and attempt to have their views aired in other publications, as in college newspaper ads. And colleges, since they own their own newspapers, should have the freedom to restrict the deniers' access to their readership. Walter Reich, former director of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, has noted that we must not confuse freedom of expression with the obligation to facilitate that expression. We must never pass a law that says Holocaust deniers may not publish their own literature, but we are not obligated to publish it for them in our own publications. The Holocaust denier Ernst Zundel, for example, submitted an advertisement to be run in Skeptic magazine, but we declined it, even though the editors of Skeptic are in favor of free speech. Being in favor of someone's right to freedom of speech is quite different from enabling that speech. An example of this important distinction concerns the Holocaust denier Bradley Smith, who publishes Smith's Report, America's only monthly Holocaust revisionist newsletter, according to its subtitle. Smith has his own website and is the author of the widely distributed pamphlet entitled The Holocaust Controversy, The Case for Open Debate. Smith makes it sound so banal and innocent. Students should be encouraged to investigate the Holocaust controversy the same way they are encouraged to investigate every other historical controversy. This isn't a radical point of view. The premises for it were worked out some time ago during a little something called the Enlightenment. Well, true enough, the Enlightenment did spawn honest and open debates on all manner of historical questions, including and especially religious, political, and ideological assumptions of centuries past. And the Enlightenment gave birth to the ideas of freedom of speech and freedom of the press. But the Enlightenment also shifted science and rationality to center stage and propounded that logical analysis and empirical evidence must take precedence over personal biases and political ideologies. In the bright light of open discussion, the truth will emerge. Let Smith publish his newsletter, make his internet postings, and distribute his pamphlets. But let's not allow him to do so without a response, without using logical analysis and empirical evidence to show his arguments for what they really are. How then should we respond to Holocaust denial or any other radical claim? This is a question of strategy. Does one ignore a false claim and hope it goes away, or stand up and refute it for all to see? A decision on this point will be different for different people and different claims. We believe that once a claim is in the public consciousness, as Holocaust denial undeniably is, It should be properly analyzed and, if appropriate, refuted vigorously in the public arena. Most Americans will say that they are in favor of free speech and that they believe in the First Amendment. They may even call themselves civil libertarians. But these same people, when their beliefs are challenged, may just as loudly proclaim that their challengers should be censored. We want again to make our stance clear. No one, in our opinion, is required to publish or aid in the presentation of the Holocaust deniers' views, but we are against legal attempts to censor those views. Such attempts are what U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis called silence coerced by law, the argument of force in its worst form. The problem was succinctly summarized by Thomas More, who would give the devil his due for his own safety's sake. Let's pretend for a moment that the majority of people deny the existence of the Holocaust and that they are in the position of power. If a mechanism for censorship exists, then the believer in the reality of the Holocaust may now be censored. Would we tolerate this? Of course not. The human mind, no matter what ideas it may generate, must never be quashed. By way of example, when evolutionists were in the minority in Tennessee in 1925, and politically powerful fundamentalists had passed legislation making it a crime to teach evolution in public schools, Clarence Darrow made this brilliant observation in his opening remarks in the Scopes trial. Darrow: "If today you can take a thing like evolution and make it a crime to teach it in the public schools, tomorrow you can make it a crime to teach it in the private schools, and next year you can make it a crime to teach it in the church. At the next session, you can ban books in the newspapers. Ignorance and fanaticism are ever busy, indeed feeding, always feeding, and gloating for more. Today it's the public school teachers, tomorrow the private, the next day the preachers and the lecturers, the magazines, the books, the newspapers. After a while, Your Honor, it is the setting of man against man, creed against creed, until the flying banners and beating drums are marching backwards to the glorious ages of the 16th century, when bigots lighted faggots to burn the man who dared to bring any intelligence and enlightenment and culture to the human mind."